This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Killing Time, hosted by two girls, no Ginger, because today is a very, very special episode of Killing Time. We have the iconic Holly Madison with us. You're the first person that we've had in studio as a guest.
Oh, thank you. I feel special.
Yeah, we're very, very excited about this. Lex, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm so excited. I've been a longtime fan.
Oh, thank you.
Huge fan of your podcast. Huge fan of you.
I'm a fan of you guys, too.
Like, we're just really excited because we did. We just got our studio up and running, and you're the first person we're having in person. So we're so stoked.
Thank you. It's so cute in here.
Thanks.
So glad you like it.
So, Holly, I met you so long ago. You were one of the first guests on Lady Gang.
Yeah, I remember. It was fun.
It was crazy. I feel like you came on as a guest not even knowing what our show was about, really.
Yeah, it was really new. I listened to it, but it was really new.
Yeah, it was so fun. And then we didn't know that you actually listened to The First Degree, so we're going to have like an on the stand.
I have one ready. I'm prepared.
So I'm so freaking excited. I'm going to give you a little bit of an intro, and then we can go into on the stand and the whole thing. So everybody knows who Holly Madison is. Like, if you have been alive in the past 20 years, you know who she is. She graced our TV on The Girls Next Door, iconic TV show. Honestly, listening to your podcast too recently and with the music from the beginning, it just brings me back.
It really does.
It's so insane.
Also, the pictures you guys post on your Instagram that are like throwbacks. It's incredible. And I know I've heard on the podcast where everyone talks about how many photos everyone took. It's such an amazing time capsule you guys have.
It really is. Like, I have crates and crates of scrapbooks. It's like receipts for days. And when I started the Instagram for the podcast, at first I didn't want to do it because it's just like impossible to grow on Instagram these days. And I was like, another thing. But I'm actually having a lot of fun with it.
You guys are doing a great job. Thanks. It's really immersive because it really does remind you. I mean, things were so different in a lot of ways, not in other ways, but it's just really fun to see everything you're wearing, because honestly, a lot of that stuff's come back too.
It really is.
I know. Oh my god, the circle.
They look like contemporary photos sometimes. Yeah. I'm like, whatever.
Have you kept any of the clothes you had back in the day?
Oh yeah, I have so many items. I don't have every single thing. I threw out a lot of the casual stuff just because it doesn't hold up that well. But I have like a full archive. I did a YouTube video on it, kind of going through some of the stuff. I have like almost everything I wore on the show.
Amazing. Awesome. I feel like now is the time to start wearing it again too.
Yeah, it is.
Like incorporating like small little things. I'm thinking about getting my belly button re-pierced. I'm like, maybe it's fun. The time to like bring it back.
Do it.
I don't know.
We keep getting new piercings every year. That is something we do.
We really do.
So, whatever.
So, your next project that you're working on is The Playboy Murders. This is a show on ID. It's airing January 23rd on Mondays at 10, 9 Central. And we're so excited about this. We want to talk to you about it a little bit because the first case in the show we actually did for the first episode
of First Degree,
which is crazy,
was Jasmine Fiore. And that's the first episode you guys are covering.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that just kind of lays the groundwork for what's to come, because that's such a harrowing case. It really is.
The details of it are so frightening, and it's just the kind of thing that could really happen to anybody. She was in a toxic relationship. You know, one of my friends knew her and they used to discuss their relationships together, but even she didn't know how dangerous it could become.
No one thinks their dramatic, screaming, anger-prone boyfriend is going to kill them. I mean, especially in Young Love, there's all this drama, people getting out of cars when they're in a fight and leaving. And it's just like, you never think someone's going to hurt you in one of those relationships. It just, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's really scary.
It is.
That case was so crazy. So what, how did you get tied to the show? Like, what has your creative process kind of been through it? Because it's such a specific show that I think is perfect for you to be involved in, especially, you know, with you kind of coming out and speaking out against a lot of things that were happening at the mansion. Mm-hmm. I think this is just a great fit for you.
Yeah, the production company approached me about it. And when I first heard the title, The Playboy Murders, I was like, no, I can't do another Playboy thing. Like, I'm at my limit. I can't handle it. But they sent over a deck, which was like a breakdown of the cases they were going to cover. And as I read through it, I was like, holy shit, I would watch this. Mm-hmm. Like, I had not heard of so many of the cases. And I was somebody who thought I knew everything about Playboy history and what happened to all the playmates. And so many of these cases I hadn't even heard of. And there were so many details that surprised me. So I definitely wanted to be involved from there.
And even with the Jasmine Fiore case, I don't think that we knew that was connected to Playboy, did we, when we were doing
it? I think we did. She was working in Vegas, like, maybe as a Playboy kind of proxy.
Yeah, at the Playboy Club and, or at least at the pool at the Palms, I know for sure. Because I talked to somebody who was the bunny mother there at the time. And she also worked at the Playboy golf events, which I used to go to those. So I'm sure we crossed paths and I just never knew.
That's so crazy.
And with any of these cases, like, did you meet anybody personally, or is it more of telling of a story from, you know, kind of your perspective connected to Playboy in general?
Definitely telling the story. I didn't meet anyone. Jasmine was probably the closest I came. I'm sure we crossed paths many times and I just didn't know. But a lot of these stories take place over so many different decades. There's some from the 70s, from the 90s. There's a case where the killer just got sentenced last week.
Oh, shit.
So really current too.
Oh my God. Yeah. So when we were researching it, I'm like, I hadn't heard about so many of these cases either. Even the one that we did for the first degree episode. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so crazy. There's so much darkness and crazy shit that's tied to the brand.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
That being said, though, you mentioned a lot of these cases span decades and they happen in the 90s or, you know, the early 2000s or 2000s or 2010s. But there is one theme that I noticed that's pervasive, and it's sort of, there is this sort of disregard for women to some degree. I mean, Stacey Arthur was what we covered this week, which is on our feed yesterday. I mean, you see how unsupported she was, you know, by the brand in her time of, you know, peril. I mean, is that sort of a theme you notice amongst the other episodes too?
Yeah, definitely. And that case in particular was really surprising to me. Yeah. And that was one of the first ones that caught my attention because I just had no clue that Playboy was ever having the Playmates speak to fans on a 1-900 number. That just seemed very off brand to me. And it ended up putting her in a life-threatening situation and it had fatal consequences.
It is crazy because Playboy always was
untouchable,
trying to be elegant. Mm-hmm. And 900 numbers were sort of seedy.
Yeah.
Especially in the 90s. It's like sort of the same thing as, like, you know, advertisements in the back of certain magazines, like right? Pages, like it just seems not Playboy. It seems more Hustler to me. But I was surprised too by that.
Yeah, I was. I mean, nothing wrong with talking on a sex line if that's what you want to do, but it definitely seemed off-brand. Because when people think of a 1-900 number, I think Playboy was trying to make it sound like, oh, no, it's not a sex line, like you just talk to fans. But come on, what are people going to expect? In the 90s, a 1-900 number was thought of as a sex line.
Well, there's also no accountability, right? So in the 90s, there's no star 69, there's no caller ID. So if someone is being perverted...
Well, and I'm sure they're not deviant, recording it the way that you would these days. Yeah.
Right. So it's like there's no... Yeah, it was really a bad idea.
Yeah.
Like for these stunning women gracing magazines that people can become obsessed with to be talking to regular people from anywhere.
I mean, yeah. And I was going to say with just the Playmates in general, it's like you guys were kind of this like untouchable, like on a pedestal, nobody could ever kind of reach you sort of a thing. So for it to be where you could just like chat somebody up. That is just like the grounds for breeding of stalking and obsession and all that kind of shit.
Yeah, there's definitely a teachable moment there, I think, for sure.
Oof. Okay, well,
I can't wait to watch all of them.
I know.
I got a sneak peek of one of them.
You did?
Yes.
I didn't.
Sorry. I forgot to forward it to you from Debbie at ID.
Okay, well, when we come back, we've got some bitching to do.
Please rise. Court is now in session.
All rise.
Call the first witness.
How do you plead? Guilty or not guilty?
Okay, so welcome to On the Stand. I'm so excited that you have an On the Stand
prepared. I'm ready.
We weren't going to do it, but if you are listening, On the Stand, every week we bring a person, place, or thing to the stand that we're either loving or hating that week. We have a healthy discussion. Vote if it's guilty or not guilty. Bring it to Instagram. You guys vote if it's guilty or not guilty. And then we see if we're like on par with everybody else's thoughts or if we're just fucking crazy.
Sometimes I get very surprised by the results.
I know.
I'm like, I know how everyone feels about this.
You're like, and everybody then loves a tuna sandwich, right?
Completely wrong.
Would you like to go first?
Yes. Okay. What I want to put on the stand is something I really hate, and that's compact car spaces. Oh. I don't understand why they exist. And for everybody out there, I don't know how common these are all over the country and all over the world, but in LA, especially like in Beverly Hills and the west side of LA, they're everywhere. And there will be places you go where I swear to God, as an SUV driver, there is nowhere for me to park because every single parking space is labeled compact. Yep. I don't understand why they exist. Like, was it supposed to be incentive for people to buy smaller cars? Like, was that the idea? I don't know. Like, why not just make big spaces, normal car spaces?
And, like, maybe have, like, three less.
Yeah.
Like, it's not making that much of a difference, I don't think.
No. It's insanity.
I drive a Jeep, and Jared, my fiancé, drives it most of the time because I love just, you know,
chilling,
going on Instagram
while he's driving you.
But he will fit that Jeep into every single compact space. Like,
that's amazing.
He will go in with, like,
revenge of the Jeep.
2 inches, and he's like, not my fault. And then I have to, like, squeeze myself, like, kind of through the side of the car. But, yeah, I don't get it.
I don't understand what the motivation is. I understand if somebody was like laying out all the parking spaces and then you get to the last spot and maybe there's not enough room. So I'm going to label that compact because not everybody's going to be able to fit in. But no, they will label every single space compact and it drives me up the wall. This is not realistic. No. It's not the way anybody lives. I don't understand it.
It's blasphemous.
We need to move to suburbia.
It is guilty.
That's the only option.
That is the only option.
You have like a compact car.
Yes.
You can scooch on in all those spaces.
Well, here at our studio, for example, this place was built in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. So we have a little garage here, and it is the tiniest, like, it's the one you parked in front of.
Yeah.
That
built for Model T's.
My car has always fit in there because I like little cars. I drive the i3. It's like a little roller skate. It's like a tiny little nerdy, like, it looks like a microwave. So mine fits in there. That being said, though, I don't like compact spaces. Like, because no one parks right and you're always jammed. I'm going guilty for sure.
People are pig parking, as Larry David says, where it's like you're like halfway into the space and then the other person's half and then they're 3/4 away. And then now there's no compact spaces anymore. Yeah. It's just normal spaces.
Yes.
Guilty.
Guilty.
Guilty all around.
Okay, I'm going to go next.
Great.
I am putting on the stand the little Playboy Bunny stickers that we would get when we would tan.
Okay.
Back in the day. Like, you'd go into the tanning bed. There was options. There was a palm tree. There was the Playboy Bunny sticker. Heart. Whatever. And then, like, you would wear it. I would wear it as, like, a badge of honor when I was, like, in seventh grade because I'm, like, I'm cool. I get to go to a tanning bed kind of a thing.
I've heard you ladies talk about that, I think, on the podcast, maybe.
Just the Playboy Bunny in general?
In regards to tanning, maybe. It was just, mention.
Did you guys do the Playboy Bunny stickers or no?
I didn't. And we didn't, like, have them at the mansion, which I'm really shocked.
I know. I'm shocked, too.
Because there were tanning beds there, and we used them. And I'm actually surprised we didn't, like, request them because I knew they existed. Like, I'm shocked that wasn't a thing. Thinking back. But the weird thing is every once in a while I'll go to a tanning salon in Vegas still, and they still offer those. It's still a thing.
Dude. Honestly, that's so nostalgic. I wish they would bring it back.
I mean, I bet that they do, but they need to bring them to spray tanning beds, or maybe I just need to buy them on Amazon because I am kind of into it the same way that I'm into re-piercing my belly button.
Yeah. It's the odds.
Like, I'm really embracing my Y2K like teenage self because I'm probably just like really terrified to age and I'm just like trying to hold on to anything.
Yeah.
But I'm like, those are some things that I feel like I could do. You do it with a spray tan, you're not hurting your skin, like, but you get to have a little... Maybe I don't do a Playboy Bunny. Maybe I do a heart or something. Yeah. Or a new symbol. Like
something.
Something.
Maybe like, what is it? The witch one. The pentagram.
The pentagram.
Oh, yeah. That would be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or some like ghost summoning.
Yeah. Something fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Make your own. That's so exciting.
I love that. Wait, let's like find one in a spell book.
I was going to say.
So you can summon some demons.
First degree tanning stickers.
Yes. God, yes.
I think it's not guilty. I'm like, I think maybe it needs to be brought back for the summer of 2023 as a fad, like as a micro trend, they're calling them now. And just like have it be a thing.
Yeah, not guilty.
Not guilty unless you're under 18 and getting the Playboy Bunny. No offense, but I'm like, where are your parents?
Yeah, that's true.
I was doing it under 18.
My parents had no idea what I... They don't know. They've never known.
They've never known.
I had my tongue pierced in high school.
That's crazy.
Disgusting. Truly disgusting. But my family had no idea. That's how elusive I was in high school.
You didn't even talk to them.
Barely. They didn't talk to me either.
Okay, what are you putting on the stand?
Okay, so mine is controversial.
Love it.
And I even don't know how I feel about it. But I feel nostalgic for it. But then also there's an inconvenience. I kind of miss body glitter.
I had body glitter on New Year's Eve.
I know. We used it. And we had like hair gems on New Year's Eve. But I kind of miss, like, I remember having like some powder puff thing with shimmer on it, a big one, like growing up, that you just do your whole thing and there was like a scented dust with it. And I'm like, I kind of miss feeling that beautiful. Like, have you ever felt like a glistening angel? Only when you've done that.
That's what I so for New Year's Eve, we went out and I bought a body glitter spray from Amazon. I've never felt younger in my life.
That is so cute. I love that.
And you could do it in your hair. You could do it on your clothes. You could do it on all your skin. And I'm like, again, this is like the Y2K things we're bringing back that I'm like, makes me feel young enough, not too young. And I don't think creepy. The Playboy Bunny sticker
girls
might be creepy,
but
body glitter, I think it's okay.
Creepy though. Like, I don't think women are creepy.
I don't think there's anything creepy about glitter.
Unless they're obsessed with something. Women, you know, but like men, women don't organically just give off creepy vibes if they're standing on a corner.
No.
Generally not. Mm-hmm. Unless they're doing something devious. We can pick up on that. But I don't know. Body glitter feels nostalgic. Like, I'm craving those like times when I was really excited to be at a nightclub. Like, excited to go to a school dance. Haven't felt like that in 10 years, at least.
I love body glitter.
Me too.
Have you guys ever been to Portofino Tan in Beverly Hills? Not to bring it back to tanning beds.
No, but I will if it's going to make me feel like that.
But they do a spray tan, and they can put a glitter in it, and they have all these different shades of glitter, although it's probably not as glistening as, like, an actual body glitter that you would use.
Gold?
They have golds. They have whites. They have a purple.
We should go. Gold would be so cool. Nice if you wanted like a really deep.
Yes. It just gives you a little bit of like a pop.
I love.
Wait, a purple pop?
Yeah.
Little alien pop?
Heck yeah. I love it. Okay, we're going. We're going. All right.
So body glitter, not guilty.
So not guilty.
Not guilty at all. Perfectly innocent.
I love this.
Okay, when we come back, we're diving in.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options and more than 60 add-ons every week. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for all of your springtime goals. If you don't have time, Factor's ready-to-eat meals are on the table in 2 minutes. So you just get to eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, cleaning up. You really just heat and savor the good stuff without all of the stress. You can customize your weekly meals with as much or as little as you need. Plus, you can pause and reschedule your deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution to premium, fast meals without the need for cooking. And they're celebrating Earth Day all month long. So look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. I'm so busy, so it's amazing to just have Factor meals in the fridge for whenever I realize that I'm starving and I don't have any time to cook anything. They're amazing, they're healthy, and they keep you fueled all day long. Head to factormeals.com/degree50 and use code degree50 to get 50% off your first month, plus 20% off your next month. That's degree50 at factormeals.com/degree50. 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Hey, there's no reason to feel sad or guilty about the things you aren't using anymore. Whether it was a fancy dress you wore to a gala, expensive heels that only go with one of your outfits, or that crossbody bag from when you were in your music festival era. Somebody out there wants what you don't, and the RealReal makes it easy to get it to them. When your past becomes their future, everyone wins, especially the planet. For The RealReal, Earth Month isn't just another month. It's what they do every day. At any given moment, they're finding new homes for over 1 million unique items within their community of 35 plus million people. They're the largest luxury reseller in the world and making a tangible difference towards a more sustainable future for fashion. Resale reduces the amount of fashion waste in landfills, lowers greenhouse gas emissions, and offers an alternative to the cycle of consumption propagated by fast fashion. The RealReal has kept over 37 million items in circulation and out of landfills. This month only, new shoppers get 20% off when they shop on TheRealReal.com using code FIRST. That's TheRealReal.com using the code FIRST.
Yeah, it's rewind time.
Okay, so we've gone through your show. Mm-hmm. Now we've been obsessively listening to your podcast, Girls
Thank
Next
you.
Level. It is so fucking good.
Thanks.
You guys do such a good job. You're and Bridget's chemistry together is it's great.
We have a lot of fun with
well,
it.
Well, you guys are trauma bonded.
Yeah. I think so, for sure.
Like,
yeah.
When I hear about how much you both went through together and then living in that environment under that roof and the politics of what you navigated, she will be your friend for life. I think you guys have such a beautiful friendship because to come out on the other side of that as two like stable, wonderful women who are good friends, like that could have really fucked anyone up, to be honest.
God.
Like
yeah,
you guys are
sure.
so strong and
thanks.
And still so nice, which is
Thank
such
you.
A refreshing. Well, listening to her, I mean, she just sounds like the nicest person.
Yeah,
exists.
She's really sweet, for sure.
Have you guys always been close, like, since the mansion? Or did you guys reconnect to do the podcast? Or what has your friendship been like?
We've always been in touch. Like, we weren't necessarily hanging out in person all the time because I was in Vegas a lot. But we never not been in touch. It's always been a thing.
Yeah, your relationship is just like so great.
Yeah,
thanks.
And then you went to the mansion before she did.
Yeah, I was there. I moved in maybe about 9 months before she started coming out with the group.
Yeah. And then you've talked about recently how you're not neurotypical.
Yeah.
And you were talking about how the mansion was really attractive to you in a way because you felt like it could be a place that you could build community and you could mm-hmm. have these connections with people that you were struggling to make in regular life.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that, like going into the mansion and what you were kind of expecting?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I started going up there, going to parties, and then I got invited to come up on the weekends for like their buffet dinner and movie, which was like a small group, like maybe 30 to 40 people would go to these pool parties and like dinner and a movie. And it just really felt like a community and it felt almost like wholesome in a way. Like, yeah, you knew this was the place that put out the magazines with nude people, but it didn't feel sketchy at all.
Yeah.
And I know people don't usually believe that when I say it, but it's true. It felt like a community. And I was brand new to LA. I had just dropped out of college and was working at a restaurant and I'd made some friends, but they also were people from out of town who'd kind of given up on LA and gone back home.
Yeah.
And I was at a point where I needed a place to live. And I thought it would just be a great idea to move into the mansion and ended up just getting in totally over my head.
But watching it in hindsight, it also doesn't look sketchy. It looks homey. Like mm-hmm. they did a really,
yeah.
whatever, you know, how, you know, when you go to places like the Grove or the Americana, we've learned in Disneyland, we mm-hmm. learned that there's like psychological aspects of how those places are built to make us feel a certain way. And the mansion sort of, at least from my perspective watching, had that quality where it's like, it wasn't this like cold, brutalist mansion. It was homey. And like, I can understand it looks so attractive to like settle
yeah.
in there.
There's, yeah, like, it seemed like it was just like a big sleepover
yeah,
for a bunch of girls that were all mm-hmm. friends.
When it didn't
and,
look
like,
cold and empty, it looked like there were reading nooks and books and like it looked yeah. like fun and it looked like a fun place to live, to be honest. Like the rooms didn't look like barracks, right? They had personality. Mm-hmm. Like I can understand as a 20-something getting there and being like, this is amazing.
Yeah, it just felt like the destination.
Yeah.
Like I remember I would come to the pool parties and, you know, after the pool parties, they'd have dinner and a movie. So I would be leaving and waiting at the front door for valet to bring my car up and it would be getting dark out and you would just see like the upstairs windows. You'd see like all the photos lining the hallway and it's just like this warm glow coming from inside and it just looked so cozy. Like mm-hmm. it just looked like a place you'd want to live mm-hmm. rather than going back to your barren apartment.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Well, and especially if it's, like, you're struggling in LA, mm-hmm. you're, like, trying to, like, get your bearings, something like that, it's like,
Yeah, it really felt like a community for sure.
Well, and just given the prestige of the brand, too. Yeah. I mean, it's also, as exciting as it is, I can imagine it was really intimidating, you know? And, yeah. like, hard to, just the politics, the more I hear about what you went through and the competitive nature of like, the pecking orders that existed. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a lot to navigate emotionally.
Yeah, it was really crazy. And when you arrived, nobody ever, like, broke down the rules for you. You just kind of right. had to stumble around and figure it out.
Trial and error. You're, like, yeah. touching, like, electric fences to mm-hmm. see, like, yeah, how to
Did you ever, like, live? Accidentally break a rule in the beginning and learn the hard way for anything?
I don't know if I accidentally broke a rule. I remember sometimes I would sit in a place I wasn't supposed to sit because there was a definite hierarchy as far as like where people would sit at the dinner table or sit in the limo. Like I sat in the wrong place in the limo once and made an enemy out of that. So it was just like little things like that would turn into big drama. Or, you know, I was driving a really beat up car in college and this other girlfriend who had got kicked out before I moved in, Hef had been leasing a car for her and she couldn't keep up the car payments, so it got repossessed. And when the car came back on the property, some of the secretaries were like, well, we should offer Holly that car because she's driving this really beat up, like probably embarrassed to have on the property car. So I accepted and it wasn't like my style. It was like this big Escalade that was on like these giant tires and like lifted. I'm talking about not being able to fit so in the compact small, car space. Like... I know. So it wasn't my style, but I was so grateful to be driving like this new comfortable car. Yeah. But all the other girls got so mad at me because when the playmate who had initially got this car, she had went out and got all these customizations put on it, which had cost Hef a lot of money and he wasn't doing that for anybody else. So even though that car wasn't their style either, they were all super mad because I had this car that like cost a little bit more than theirs. Mm-hmm. So it was just like you earned resentment without even trying. Yeah. It was weird.
I can't even imagine being around all of those women and having, it's just like this, like, vague kind of competition going mm-hmm. around and like unspoken sort of things like that has just got to be so confusing to navigate, especially when you're first moving in there.
Well, yeah, for sure. With the stakes being what they are. That's yeah. what I think about a lot when I listen to your podcast. It's like I think about the stakes. And although you have talked about he said at one point that he wasn't going to put girlfriends in the magazine, mm-hmm. but in the past he had. Right. So it's like everyone's after fame and everyone's after this or just a place in Hef's life. Yeah. And as you're kind of getting that just by Hef liking you the most, I'm sure you were a target. You
know, oh,
I think
for
about
sure.
I think about that all. I was yeah. listening to those episodes with these things happening at dinner and you having to go out with these women and I'm just like, that is sounds so hard. That sounds really hard.
Yeah, I was a target because I was a homebody. Yeah, like at first yeah. they loved that because none of them wanted to like sit next to Hef at the, they didn't even want to go to the buffet dinner. So they loved it that I was doing that because they thought that took kind of heat off of them. Yeah. But then Hef started using it. So if somebody else was staying out a little bit too late, why can't you just be good like Holly? And then it was like, they yes. all turned on me when he started using that.
You're like, oh my God. I was going to ask you about that because I heard you talking in your podcast about that. Uh-huh. I'm like, oh my God, that's such like
manipulative.
So manipulative. Mm-hmm. It probably makes you feel so horrible because you're like, I'm just being myself.
Yeah, you can't win.
You're like, I can't change what I'm doing. I'm like actually not trying to like, you know, be a part of all of this kind of shit.
Yeah, well, it's nuts.
And you're getting it from both sides because all the aspects of the mansion are coercive. Mm-hmm. So you have all of these mechanisms in place to make you more reliant and vying for those that spot. But then everyone's also against you. It's like you're fighting two kind of forces at the same time. I just yeah. think that like it wasn't a social experiment, but like looking back on Girls Next Door now, yes. like do you kind of see it that way?
I feel like that a little bit because I feel like I kind of moved in. As far as being one of Hef's girlfriends, I was kind of there during like the best of times and worst of times. Yeah. Best of times because yeah. we got a TV show out of it. But worst of times because the first 3 years I moved there before the TV show, it was just a nightmare. And I felt like right when I moved in, he'd kind of reached a place where he'd been out of his marriage for several years and had had all these girlfriends and was loving the publicity as being the guy with seven girlfriends. But he noticed that when he would put them in the magazine, they'd leave right after. And I feel like I arrived just at the wrong time as far as him starting to feel like, okay, what can I do to like finesse this and control this more? Like, what can I do to make people stick around longer, give them enough so that they stay, but not enough so that they have any confidence? Like, how can I felt like I was kind of the target of that experiment, like the target of his boredom or the target of him trying to turn it into like the next step of whatever.
And I want to know like your first impressions of Hef, mm-hmm. and because obviously he seems like a manipulator, seemed like he was a manipulator, maybe a little bit of a narcissist, maybe some like, I don't know, some of those sort of qualities. Yeah. And obviously those are very hard to detect when you first meet somebody. Mm-hmm. Like that's something that you kind of learn throughout time once you start getting to know somebody. Like what were the first impressions of him?
My first impressions of Hef, I mean, I think just hearing about him through society, you think he's like this controversial, sketchy character. But then when you start going to the mansion, you realize, at least according to everybody who surrounds him and what you see of him during those social interactions, you think, oh, he's not that at all. And, you know, everybody loves a contrast story. Everybody loves seeing something. Oh, that's not it at all. It's not how the media portrays him. He's really like the most generous host and like the best friend. And he's really like a romantic at heart. And the way life was kind of situated at the mansion, it reminds me of like Louis XIV. Like everything revolved around him. Everybody who stayed on the guest list because they were the most devoted, most sycophantic. I mean, plenty of nice people too, but everybody just worshipped him and just thought he was the best guy and the best host. And that was all I was seeing. I was seeing this, you know, creative genius who'd built all this. And he just seemed like the most fascinating person.
That's so crazy.
Yeah.
It's so crazy. And when I listened to the podcast, one of the most profound things that you said, an anecdote you shared that I keep thinking about was when you talked about, I don't remember which episode, but you talked about how you were depressed and you wanted to go to therapy. And he was like, no, they're just going to tell you to leave me, that you're not happy here.
Yeah.
And then finally he agreed. But it was a therapist he knew or a psychiatrist who would prescribe based on like maybe his desires, you know. Is that true? And like looking back on that now, that feels
that's so crazy.
Coercive and controlling and dangerous.
Yeah, it's really crazy. I was having a talk with him one night and I was just like at the point where I was in tears because what I was trying to do was say I wanted to work while I was still there and I was saying to him, I'm like, you're not going to be around forever. And then he was yelling at me like, well, what's wrong with spending a few years of your life with me? Like he'd always turn it around like a guilty thing.
Oh, yeah.
But he didn't want me to work while I was there and I wanted to work. I wanted to go out on auditions and do things. And I'm like, but you know, what am I going to do later and things like that? And I told him I was really depressed and I wanted to go to therapy. He goes, well, I'm not a fan of you going to a therapist because they're just going to tell you to leave me. I think you should talk to Mary about it, his secretary. So I talked to Mary about it. And eventually I was allowed to go see a therapist, but it was somebody that like Hef's doctor referred. So, you know, it was somebody within the network.
It was in the bubble.
The doctor that was giving him all the Quaaludes probably.
And then, so I go to the therapist and this was right before we started filming the show. And he said, well, you're just stressed out because of this upcoming TV show. So I'm going to put you on an antidepressant. Oh so God. that was where that went.
Can we talk about his fake crying?
Oh my God, the fake crying, you guys. It was so bad because it was so obvious. And it was something that even in the moment, even when I was buying into like being in love with him and thinking he was a great person, like I still knew he was fake crying. Like I couldn't even fool myself out of
that.
Were
there tears coming out or was it just like the
not really, it was like really bad acting, really bad crocodile tears. But it would always happen at a moment where you just didn't know what to do because this whole situation is like the emperor's new clothes. You don't want to piss him off. You don't want to, like, I can't just sit there and be like, bro, why are you fake crying? Like that would have never flown. That would have been like an uproar. So you're kind of just stopped in your tracks because you don't know what to do because this old man is like crying at you.
Ew.
But you can't call him out. And I remember even not long after Kendra moved in, she was talking to Bridget and I, and she goes, so he comes into my room and he starts fake crying, just like dumbfounded. And none of us knew what to do. Like we all recognized it, that he was doing it, but it was just something that kind of stopped you dead in your tracks because you had no tool.
You're like, this is too weird. It's like
that.
My dad fake crying at me or my mom. Like I'd be like, you're not really crying. But it also
so
just
obvious.
Goes to show that men, I always think, since
so
I've been a child,
stupid.
I think that I'm going to feel different when I'm older. Mm-hmm. It just goes to show that, like, it doesn't matter what age a man is, they all do this shit. They really do.
What, fake cry?
they're just fucking babies.
Well, yeah.
They're just like, they'll do whatever to like mitigate a situation.
He was doing this obviously in situations that he was probably back up against the wall and he was like trying to manipulate you or control you in some sense.
Yeah. Right? If he wanted to just shut down an argument or something.
Yeah.
He just goes...
Yeah.
It's like, and I can visualize that so perfectly, and it's so gross. Mm-hmm. It's so cringy.
Well, no one's going to be like, they're there. Like, we just want it to stop. Yeah. Whatever we have to do.
Exactly.
Oh my God. I also want to talk about the fact that you didn't sign an NDA, because I think that is one of the craziest things ever. As
why
women who have signed many.
I know exactly why he didn't want him to. Why didn't
really?
Want to.
What is the reason? Because it's like, obviously, we've all signed many contracts in our professional lives. And
it's kind of baseline.
Hearing that for like the Playboy Mansion and with Hugh Hefner, I'm like, that is the craziest thing. That would be the first person I would be like, to even walk into the mansion, you would think that you'd have to sign an NDA.
Yeah, well, employees did, but girlfriends never did, or any woman that, you know, came into the house. And my theory on why that is he was so greedy about getting so many people to come up into the bedroom with him. Like, he would bring women home from the clubs, you know, whatever. And if he would have had to stop a woman or have a security or somebody stop a woman at any point and be like, hey, can you sign this? That would give someone pause. No matter how fucked up they are, they're going to be like, wait, what am I getting into? Wait, never mind. And he doesn't want anything standing in the way.
It's a buzz kill.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Like, he would rather have people going and talking all kinds of shit. And back then, like, there wasn't social media. People didn't have the voices they do now.
Yeah.
Like, it was easy for him. He had spies in the publishing industry. So anytime somebody was like trying to shop around a book or something,
he'd kill it.
Usually it would get shut down, or once it came out, it just wouldn't do anything because it wouldn't get the press.
Well, and that, yeah, that's so crazy. Because, like, you do look back and there's kind of this sense of, there isn't really a negative connotation. Once you start learning about what was happening, obviously, yes. But, like, as an outsider kind of looking at the brand, it was sort of like, oh, it's kind of, like, nice in a way. Like,
yeah, it was like the Disney of, like, adult content.
Yes.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I would be so interested to hear what you think, because listening to you on Girls Next Level and just, I don't know, I follow you on social media and everything. You seem very aware about psychology and things like that. If you were to diagnose him, and I know you're not a doctor, but is there like sex addiction? Like, it seems like this like insatiable hole. I know you've described him on the podcast as insecure, like that if he doesn't have women walking next to him into a party, he like won't go and he'll get mad if people aren't like... So it's like, what do you think is driving those compulsions, like the bedroom compulsions and the more validation, more fake women? Crime. Like, there's obviously a hole there from his childhood, but I get really deep in the weeds on this shit. But if you have any, you know, insight or theories, I'd be so interested to hear.
Yeah, I don't really know what the actual cause of it is. Like, people have asked me that a lot, like, what in his childhood made him this way? And he would have little anecdotes or stories like, oh, his parents weren't affectionate, or oh, the girl he asked to the hayride in high school turned him down, or his wife cheated on him right before he got married, or like things like this. But I don't know. Other than, I mean, I think also like success at a young age and just having people flock to him and being surrounded by yes people for so many years kind of contributes to it. But there was a huge insecurity that people just wouldn't have guessed. He was so insecure about, you know, being seen as not really sleeping with his girlfriends. Because when people would go talk shit, he wouldn't really care unless one of his girlfriends like went on Howard Stern and said, no, we don't really have sex. That would be the be all end all. Like, I remember he had a videotape
that would be bad.
A Howard Stern interview of one of his girlfriends had gone on and said, no, we don't really sleep together. And he drew a skull on it.
No.
And like, that was his symbol for like, this is a fucked interview.
No way.
Like, people could say all kinds of bad things about him and it was like water off a duck's back. He didn't really care. But if a girl would go out and say, no, he doesn't really have sex with his girlfriends, whoa, that was a thing.
That is so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So you also talk, I mean, obviously you were there for a long, long time at the mansion, and you've kind of talked about feeling like you had a sense of like Stockholm syndrome, especially with him as like a captor, quote unquote, kind of a thing. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because obviously, you know, people that are outside of this situation, they're like, well, if it was so horrible, why'd you stay in the situation? Yeah. And we all, especially if you're a true crime fan, I think we all know why a lot of people get stuck in situations mm-hmm. like that. So can you give a little bit of an insight to your situation?
Yeah, I think for me, it was so easy to identify with him, not only because of like the love bombing and just the time we spent together, but also getting back to being like not neurotypical. I had had a hard time just bonding with people throughout my life. And yeah. I had never really bonded too much with boys my own age. And to be able to sit with somebody and talk about old movies that I was interested in and things like that, I thought, well, you know what, maybe this is my person, because I've had such trouble throughout my life bonding with people, and to have kind of a connection with somebody, like maybe this was just what was meant to be. So I really felt like I was connecting with him, but also because there were so many other women in that group, and it was so easy to be turned against them and for all of us to be turned against each other, just because everybody was so competitive in the situation. And he would kind of do little things behind the scenes that I wasn't really aware of at the time to kind of like stoke the drama. For me, it was so easy to think the problem was the other women for so many years. I just yeah. thought if everybody else was gone, we could just live in peace.
But sometimes the problem was the other women. Like we talked a few months ago about doing a different story possibly mm-hmm. before the ID show was in the works. And I know a lot of these people who tried to get in with Hef would then go share stuff. And I, you know,
yeah.
women sometimes are the problem in this situation. And the things you've described on the podcast, like a lot of cruelty, mm-hmm. like a lot of really needless, senseless, just straight up cruel stuff going on. And I think that is really hard, because you were at least in the same age group as all these women. You'd think that you'd all, like in you and Bridget did, like band mm-hmm. together and get what you can out of a situation that's hard.
Yeah.
And that didn't always happen.
Yeah, definitely not all the women were innocent for yeah. sure. And that especially made it so easy for me to be like, well, they're the problem and he's sure. not. Yeah. He's just a nice guy who can't find the right people. Like as stupid as that sounds, that's kind of what I bought into.
Yeah.
But when you're in your life, if you have no kind of safe space or nobody in your immediate vicinity in the city you live in
yeah.
that you can really connect with, and that's your one person, and that's what you feel like is all you have. Because it was even a while before Bridget and I became friends, and I just didn't have a friend. And especially in the time before social media and people weren't texting, and it was a little bit harder to keep in touch just yeah. with people in general. He just felt like he was my rock at the time, and I didn't want to see anything wrong with him.
Yeah. Well, you did amazing, and you handled yourself like a champ, because thanks. People are so mean.
Well, and yeah. I watched it was the Secrets of Playboy, mm-hmm. I think it was called, your episode on it. And it was interesting because there was like two of his friends that were also on the same episode, mm-hmm. and they were kind of giving the whole anecdote about like, oh, like, I mean, Hef's an amazing guy. Like all we yeah. saw was like, just like a generous blah, 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 blah. Like, what do you think of about people like that, where it's like, I mean, we see this happen mm-hmm. so many times with murderers or true crime cases where it's like, you know, he was just like the best person ever, like such a great friend. And then there's this other side to people that nobody sees. And you had such an intimate mm-hmm. relationship with him. Like you saw this other side. Like, what do you think about people kind of giving that sort of feedback and saying that they knew him?
Yeah. I mean, it's different depending on who says it. Like some people who come out and defend him, I'm like, no, you know, there's more going on there. You're just still trying to defend the thing because yeah. you define yourself by being a Playboy friend still mm-hmm. to this day.
Right.
But I think a lot of people genuinely didn't see that side to him, because I didn't when I was at that level. When I knew him on just a buffet movie basis, I thought he was amazing.
Yeah.
You just don't see the other side when you're in a close relationship and when you have to like really trudge through the drama with him.
Well, and he makes it feel like you won a prize because you're in the mm-hmm. spot, because all these other people are vying. And in the other women's defense, it's set up to be adversarial. Like Absolutely. None of you won. And yeah. if you had met any of those mean girls on the street under different circumstances, you probably would have gotten along fine. But like that whole situation is set up to be like, who's the prettiest? Who's the most likable? Who does Hef yeah. like the most? Mm-hmm. Who's the skinniest? Who's this? Who's more Hef's type? Who's the most this? And it's like, how are you going to get along?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
It's incredible that you and Bridget did.
Yeah, you're set up to fail.
You know, like there's no room for like female camaraderie when the stakes are so high.
Exactly.
You know?
And it's like, who might get in the magazine? Who might be the one standing next to Hef when he does this commercial?
And, like, might not. They're all maybe not. Mm-hmm. They're all like false promises anyway.
Yeah.
But it was just to control all of you. And I think he's not a stupid man. I mean, he built a empire that's unmatched to this day, mm-hmm. right? But I mean, to be that smart, you're aware of kind of what you're doing and the control you have over people, and there's no getting around that, you know?
Absolutely.
So I want to ask you about like how you felt when it was coming to like Keeping Up with Appearances. Mm-hmm. I can't remember who said it, but something about like tits on a stick or something like that.
Yes. That's how one of his friends described Hef's type, tits on a stick, like completely skinny, but like with huge boobs.
Like, how was that for you? It's like, you're in the spotlight, mm-hmm. you're on now a TV show, like, you know, being a normal woman without anybody looking at you, like, it's hard enough to try to like be okay with yourself. Like, that is such a specific environment that you were living mm-hmm. in that I can't imagine how much pressure that you had to try to like keep up with the Joneses in a sense.
Yeah. And, you know, he would tell me that the reason I couldn't be in the magazine was I just wasn't photogenic. And you're just kind of like picking yourself apart. Like, what's wrong with me? Because you're looking at all these other women who are getting it every month.
I cannot fucking believe he said that to you. I cannot fucking believe that. That makes me so mad, because you're like, here in person, you're like one of the most beautiful
people you're so sweet. I've Thank ever you.
Seen. No, but literally. But like, I had an ex once who said, like, that shit is meant to like reverberate in your consciousness.
Forever.
In your subconscious. Like, that shit hurts a long time.
Oh my God. And you're constantly wondering, like, what's wrong with me? And I had dysmorphia and I always felt like I was fat and I always felt like I needed to diet. God. And you know what else was really strange? And Bridget and I are going to get into this when we talk about the next episode where we shoot our pictorial is... So the three of us, like the outside world, would look at Hef's girlfriends and be like, you guys are clones. You all look the same.
Yeah.
And there's a shot in episode 7 of season 1 of Girls Next Door where Bridget sees Kendra from a little bit of a distance. She's like, oh, Holly. Oh, wait. Sorry. I thought you were Holly. Blah, blah, blah. So like, we can mistake each other for each other sometimes. But I'm telling you, in the moment when I lived there, I was made to feel like Kendra was a 10 and I was like a 5. It was,
oh my God.
And now I look back on it and I'm like, yeah, she looks great. Like, there's plenty of times I look at pictures of my scrapbook and I think Kendra looks the best. But there's plenty of times I think Bridget looks the best. And there's plenty of times I think I look the best. You know, it's kind of like even. But back then, I was made to feel like there was so much of a disparity and like I was just barely lucky to be there. And it's just crazy looking back.
You're all gorgeous. But you're different.
Yeah, you're different.
And that's
people.
Why you can't ever look the same. But like that, that really hurts like my 21-year-old self. Like being told, you're just not photogenic, I'd fucking die. I'd be like, what do I need to fix?
Yeah.
Like at that time, all of us are so impressionable and be like, I got to fix whatever it is, especially an authority figure on beauty, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and like, it's like that's your whole life and the whole world is watching you too. Like there are so many other aspects, like me thinking about myself just being like a normal person and all the pressure I put on myself, like that is just enormous for somebody to go through.
Yeah, for sure. And you just feel like at the mansion, you know, your entire value is just based on how you look and how compliant you are and how young you are. So it really turned into a complex.
Well, I listened to the episode where you talked about cutting your hair
mm-hmm.
and his response to that. And I was so fucking mad because I have seen photos of you. I vaguely remember watching the episodes where you have your hair like you look fucking gorgeous.
Thanks.
You look like a bombshell. You have the face for it. You're Thanks. Not like... Some people can't pull off a short hair.
I can't.
You really did, though.
Thanks.
And to hear that he made you feel bad about it fucking sucks.
Ew, men should just
Yeah, it was
opinion.
Crazy.
You have no hair. Men have this much hair. What do you know about hairstyles?
Okay, so I want to ask you about, okay, when you put out your first book, like you're mm-hmm. actually, you left the mansion and you're starting to kind of speak out.
Yeah.
What was the response from people, like from Hef, from people at the mansion? Like, did you get any threats? Was there anything scary about speaking your truth about what your experiences were?
I didn't get any direct threats, but I refer to like the 2 weeks of press I did. Like, I did a week for each book because I did a book right after. And the book after, called The Vegas Diaries, like that didn't have anything negative about anybody in it.
Yeah.
But because I had just put out Down the Rabbit Hole the year before, everybody in the press treated me like I was coming out with like another book
Exposed.
Where I was slammed. Yeah, exactly.
Clickbaity.
Yeah.
Because you're good shit.
Thanks. And those weeks were hell. Like, I'm grateful for them because the books were incredibly successful. And sometimes you need that kind of press to get attention. But they were two of the most stressful weeks of my life. Like, the book came out before the Me Too movement had really gone mainstream. So people didn't really understand what I was complaining about. Like, why is the casting couch a bad thing? You cooperated, you know? And I just, when I was out doing those press tours, I felt like I was a politician involved in a scandal. Like, the questions people would ask me and just the way I was treated, it was so stressful. And so many women too would write think pieces that would be like on the front page of the New York Daily News the next day and just say horrible things about me. Like the one on the front page of the New York Daily News, the woman called me a heifer several times in the article and tried to put me down for like working at Hooters when I was in college. And yeah,
we don't need any more think pieces. There's nothing good that comes from a think.
I honestly ever. Don't care what anyone thinks. Everyone is a fucking critic. If you've never done a single thing in your life, you can literally be sitting on a couch your whole life and criticize everyone else's ambitions.
No, the people
or
writing
lives.
Think pieces are not out there experiencing life.
And you know what? Like, no. You got into that situation really fucking young. You came here, you didn't know anyone. It makes me so mad to hear some of this shit. Like,
did you, like, were there, because it's like you look back on these interviews that like Britney Spears did, or like Barbara Walters doing Britney Spears, and you're like, holy fucking shit. Like, some of these questions that are being asked are so unbelievable.
Yeah.
Like, were there any questions that stuck out in your mind that people are trying to pry or that were so unacceptable back in the day for you?
People would always ask really explicit sexual questions. And so, you know, we were used to it at the mansion, and we had got to the point where we had like clever little comebacks. Like, I can't remember what they were now, but we would just say like cute, coy little things that would just be kind of funny and cute and like on brand for Playboy. But the interviewers wouldn't let that rest. They'd be like, no, so like, how does it work? Like, are you guys hooking up with each other? And they, it just, like, they wouldn't even let us let ourselves off gracefully. Yeah. It was rough. And even when I was doing my tour for my book, you know, I remember somebody was interviewing me once, and I was talking about everything that happened, and they go, yeah, but he bought you gifts, right? Like, that just excuses everything.
Yeah, things make my emotional pain go away.
Yeah, thank you. We love an emotionally abusive relationship with gifts. With gifts like, the reason to get you back.
Yeah, buy the love back. Like, no.
Oh my God, that's so insane. Yeah.
You're amazing, by the way. Because you have done so much, and you have this amazing life, and you have these kids, and you have everything you're doing in spite of all that, which is really something. Because I'm telling you, people get messed up over way less. Like, well, and you're really fucking amazing.
Especially to be speaking out, like you said, before Me Too, before people actually took, you know, emotional abuse and all these things kind of seriously. Mm-hmm. Like, that's got to be hard because nobody's believing you. Nobody's taking you seriously. And you're just like trying so hard to get your truth and your message out. And it's just kind of, I'm sure, being laughed out in a sense.
Yeah. And you would even have other women who were in the situation who would come out and slam me and try to accuse me of lying when they saw what was going on.
Well, because they saw it as an opportunity to suck up to Playboy.
Yeah,
to,
like, exactly.
Let me defend Playboy, because everybody's after the same thing.
It's they want to get back on the party list or whatever. It's like, they're like, you guys.
But that's the thing. It's like, when you learn that, it's like everybody's agenda.
Everybody has an agenda,
Everybody has an agenda, unless they don't. And it's easy to tell when people are sincere or whatever. But in those situations, and that's why Playboy and your experience is so fascinating, because you're dealing with, like, power, money, beautiful women, and, like, and men on the outskirts vying for all of it. It's such a recipe for
disaster. You said, it's like, it is a social experiment.
No, it's like Lord of the Flies, but like it's like Hunger Games.
Yeah,
at Playboy.
It,
you know,
felt like
that's
that,
like,
for sure.
That's what it seems like, because it's like the biggest room and the better room, and then this, and like privileges you earn or privileges you lose. Go ask Hef for cash. That blew my mind.
Yeah,
that you had to ask Hef for money, even if he was busy all day. You'd have to like track him down and wait outside of a meeting to try to be like, can I have my allowance? And I'm like, what a power trip that is for him.
I mean, it's insane.
Yeah, like, it would have been so easy for the secretaries to just hand out an envelope of money every week.
Pick it up from
the
office.
They wanted to make it so hard for you.
Yeah, but
no,
you had to go track him down.
It.
Yeah, and then he would look at his little book where he'd write down notes about people and be like, well, you didn't do this week, or you didn't do that. And it was just like, whoa.
I need to ask about,
because you
this.
Can't be on your period every week to get out of it.
Yeah.
I need to ask about this book, because it was like his little black book, right? And it was like, he documented when he was having sex with different people. What else was he
putting in? Everybody who came up, and I mean, I don't know everything that was in that book, but he would keep track of like when everybody collected their allowance, who he had sex with each night, et cetera, et cetera. It's just gross.
Ew, it's so gross. Mm-hmm. And then I think you had mentioned on your podcast at some point something about like him having like a stash of like revenge porn-ish sort of things from some of the women.
Yeah, well, he would take pictures. He'd have a disposable camera he'd take with him every night when we went out. And he'd take pictures in the limo. And sometimes we'd be drinking or we'd be being silly and flashing or like posing with each other or whatever.
Yeah.
And then he'd take pictures like in the bedroom or like in the bathtub and things like that. And this would involve people, like women who were from out of town staying at the mansion testing for Playmate. He would have pictures of them. He'd put them in a scrapbook with their full name and everything. And some of these women would not get centerfold. They'd never come back. They'd never, like, that was just one night of nothing for them. Like, they probably look back and think that was a mistake, I would imagine. Like, what the hell was that? And then years later, when I was still at the mansion, he made a comment to somebody about how after he died, he was donating his scrapbooks to a library. And I was horrified.
Oh, my God.
Because I'm like, library. Somebody is. Yeah. Because I'm like, somebody's going to see all that shit. And there's all these women who probably don't even remember being photographed because they were so library? Fucked up. I don't know where his scrapbooks are. Somebody told me they went to UCLA. I don't know if that's true.
I mean, nobody should be. That is like, nobody consented to any of those pictures.
Nobody
being
did.
Taken.
It's
like,
disgusting.
That man, should be oh man.
Burned, to yeah. be honest. Like, that's nobody's property at this point.
Yeah.
Definitely not a museum.
I'm so fascinated, though.
My last question, kind of like to wrap this all in a bow. Uh-huh. I'm very interested in how you felt when he died. Like, you had such a complicated mm-hmm. relationship with him. Like, what did you feel like when it was all kind of over?
You know what's crazy is I really had no feelings. And that's because when I decided to leave him after being with him for 7 years, it was because I had all these realizations at once and just everything had been kind of crashing down on me. And I was realizing all the things I'd been trying not to see for so long. I realized that he had been pitting us all against each other when he knew how hurtful all the drama was to me. And he'd been acting innocent the whole time. And he got really verbally abusive with me during the last couple of months. I just couldn't put up with it anymore. And I'd had all these realizations and it just kind of freaked me out because you realize this person I was with for 7 years, I had an image in my mind of who this person was and who this person that I loved was. And he wasn't that at all. So when you have such a break in your mind on, wow, none of that was true that you were thinking this whole time, this is who he really is. It's almost like I started to think of him as like a robot kind of because I left. And then when my spinoff show got picked up by E, I had to use the same producer that had produced Girls Next Door because they'd made us sign contracts in the last season. And in the contract, it said if E picks up a spinoff with any of these girls, they have to use the same production company. And that producer was very close with Hef. So we were still kind of tied from a distance a little bit while I was doing that spinoff show. And the producer would always try and get me to get on the phone with Hef. Like, you should really talk to him. Do you want to talk to him? And I'd like be in his office and be like, I'm going to call him right now. Do you want to talk to him? I'm like, no, absolutely. I didn't want to. Like, I did a couple scenes with him on my show because I felt a little more safe because the cameras were there.
Yeah.
I didn't want to have a conversation with him. It freaked me out so bad. And it freaked me out because I just felt like he was just going to say all fake shit to me. It was all going to be manipulative. It was all going to be designed to get whatever reaction he wanted out of me. And that really freaked me out. So I just started thinking of him almost as a robot. So when he passed away, I mean, it wasn't totally unexpected because he was so old, but also I had just realized that the person I cared about didn't exist. It was all a figment of my imagination. So I didn't really feel anything. Everybody was expecting me to post things on social media. They were like condemning me for not posting, which, by the way, if I had feelings and had been mourning, no one should be expected to mourn publicly. Like, let's just,
they would have dragged
you
for that
on
the
stand.
If you had posted, they would have been like, you left him, you don't
love
him.
Now you're posting a picture.
Like, there's no winning for you there.
People
just gotta
judge people for how they deal with grief.
Exactly.
But like, you couldn't have won in that situation.
No.
Yeah, it was crazy. So,
oh my goodness,
dude,
you're badass.
What a wild ride, and you're fucking, you're killing it.
Thank
always.
You.
Like,
thank you so much.
We love you so much.
And you know what? Those mean chicks, they're not doing anything.
What's this? Well, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
We love you so much.
Thank you.
You're the best.
Too. Thanks for having me.
Capella University is rethinking higher education. With their game-changing FlexPath format, you can earn your degree on your schedule, so you can fit education seamlessly into your life. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.